When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.
Hey guys, and welcome to Mysteries and Histories with me, your host, Georgia Marie. This podcast audio is adapted from my YouTube channel. I wanted to make my content more accessible for those of you on the go, and we all love a podcast. So if I ever reference anything on screen or a photograph, please bear in mind this audio was originally made for video. It won't hinder your listening experience at all, but just to save any confusion. And if you do want to go and subscribe to my channel, I'm just Georgia Marie over on YouTube. And with that, let's get into it. It was the 15th of July 1992 when a man walking on Wimbledon Common in London came across a sight he would never be able to forget. A blood-soaked young boy, a toddler, sitting on the ground holding onto his mother's arm. She'd been brutally attacked and hadn't survived, and soon everyone across the UK would know her name, Rachel Nickell. This would become one of the biggest, most convoluted police investigations this country has ever seen, but please do not mistake that for this being a good investigation, because the search for Rachel's killer caused so many people so much pain. The system didn't work, and because of egos, because of the investigators' refusal to accept that they might be wrong, this took 16 years to solve, and it really, really shouldn't have. This is the story of Rachel Nickell and the Met Police's baffling insistence that they knew who had committed this crime, despite there being no evidence to prove as such. Finally, in 2008, a man would be convicted of her murder, but it was a very difficult and arduous journey to get to that point. I don't often cover solved cases on my platforms. I much prefer to focus my attention on the unsolved, the people and the victims who need my voice. But occasionally there is a lesson to be learned from solved cases, injustices that need to be spoken about to ensure that they never happen again, some sort of moral to be learned. I recently heard this full story for myself for the very first time, and I was just shocked at how this investigation was allowed to happen. But I suppose I should never be shocked at the actions of the Met Police. Like, it just happens time and time again. They never fail to amaze me. So, Rachel Jane Nickell was born on the 23rd of November 1968 to Andrew and Monica Nickell. She grew up in Essex, not far from Colchester, and she was proven from a young age to be a really, really talented dancer. Or just an all-round talented performer, singing and acting too. Along with her absolutely gorgeous looks, her teachers at the Essex Dance Theatre thought that this could be something that she pursued as a career, but in the end, Rachel decided to go to uni in London to study English and History. Whilst in London, out on her own at uni, she gets a job as a lifeguard at a pool in Richmond, and it's there that she meets a man called Andre Hanscom. The pair immediately hit it off. They're just this beautiful couple who seem to be made for each other. And that's probably a good thing, because just after a few months together, Rachel fell pregnant. After a year, they had their son Alex, and the family moved to a place in Balham in South London, along with their dog, Molly. With a baby now, Rachel decides to put her degree on the back burner, wanting to be there fully for her son. She just became this full-time mum, and she adored it. It was all she ever wanted. Even when she was offered modelling work, which is no surprise because she was really, really beautiful, she just had this like striking face, she turned it down because her only goal was to be a good mum and hopefully one day make it as a children's television presenter. And people in her life really believed that she would have been able to do this, like she had everything in her to be a presenter. And Rachel at this time was still really young herself. She was just 23 years old. She should have had all the time in the world to make her dreams come true and raise her son just like she wanted. Andre has since said to The Guardian that him and Rachel had a fairly normal dynamic, remembering that this was the early 90s. He worked full-time, Rachel stayed at home with their son, Alex. Andre said at the time that he was kind of a bit on the outside, like Alex and Rachel had such a strong relationship, such a strong bond, that Andre always felt just like a bit on the outskirts. Alex was very much a mummy's boy, and she dealt with all the sort of day-to-day runnings of his life. Like, she was there for her son 24/7, and Andre, he worked. So, on the morning of the 15th of July 1992, Rachel decides to take Alex and their dog Molly out for a walk on Wimbledon Common. Despite being such a built-up city, London actually has a huge amount of green space. It's made of 40% public green space, that's 3,000 parks totaling 35,000 acres. So when you're in London, you're never going to be short of places to go for a walk, touch some grass, get some fresh air. It's one of the best things about the city. Although Rachel lived in Balham, she didn't always feel super safe in the green spaces around there, so she'd often make the effort to go to Wimbledon Common for their dog walks. And it was just a bit of a bigger space anyway, like more for Molly to explore. 1,100 acres, and there were always plenty of people around, so like Rachel never felt unsafe there. And that morning walk started like any other. There were no big warning signs, nothing that would have made Rachel think that something bad was about to happen. But at 10:20 a.m, as they walk through a slightly more secluded area, a man appears and just attacks. Alex, who's just 2 years old, is shoved away from his mother, he's knocked to the ground, and Rachel is stabbed a total of 49 times. She's sexually assaulted at the same time, and one of the stabs in the throat was so ferocious that she was almost decapitated. And then the attacker just flees. At 10:45 a.m, a man called Michael Murray was taking his own dog for a walk on the common when he saw in the secluded area what he thought was somebody sunbathing. But as he got closer and closer, he realised that he'd never been more wrong. The scene was about as horrifying as you would expect. 2-year-old Alex crying next to the body of his mother, repeating, "Get up, mummy, get up." He was gripping onto her arm tightly, and he was also covered in her blood. This is what Michael Murray says in a documentary anyway, a real crime episode about this case. Other sources say that Alex walked out of the clearing of his own accord and that led people to find Rachel's body. Either way, it's pretty harrowing. In an interview with Good Morning Britain in 2021, Alex says that he still remembers a decent amount from that terrible day. Obviously, he's now an adult in his 30s. He remembers them all waving bye to Andre that morning. He remembers walking hand in hand with his mum. He remembers Molly and the sun in the sky. He then remembers a stranger coming towards them. He remembers being grabbed and dragged and roughed around, and the same thing happening to his mum. He said he then got up and ran towards her, but she just looked peaceful. In his memory, he asked her to get up, mummy, 3 times before realising that she was gone and she just wasn't coming back.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle with ultra-titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time for water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl. It's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl. Happy Friday. It's Jen. Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts. Like, last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
And then he just sat with her and waited. The next thing he remembers is walking out onto the field again and multiple families, mums with kids, coming forwards to help him. Once the emergency services arrived, he was sedated and woke up hours later in hospital. And he says just the main memories that he has of his mother today are just pure love. Like, she loved him so deeply and he remembers that. Police soon arrived at the scene and the officers present said that this was just the most horrific, vicious attack they had ever seen. It was like something out of a horror movie, and the investigation was immediately in full force to find her killer. Because if somebody could do something like this in broad daylight, even with a witness in the form of Alex, there was no doubt they would strike again. But the question was, how soon? Were they going to strike again that very day, or a week later, or in a month's time? They didn't know. They just knew they had to find him, and quick. Andre was quickly informed of Rachel's murder and he rushed to attend his son's bedside in hospital. And luckily, Alex was entirely physically unharmed, but you couldn't say the same mentally. And as you can imagine, this case was soon to become a media sensation. An attractive, white, blonde young woman, a mother being attacked in broad daylight whilst her son was with her. Like, this was going to be a media dream. It was going to sell a lot of papers. And that it very much did. But at the time, Rachel's parents, Andrew and Monica, were on holiday in Canada and it took the police 4 days to track them down. Officers had to literally fly to Canada to break the news to them before they saw it in the papers. And thank God they managed to reach them in time. Like, this was 1992, so social media wasn't a thing, news didn't travel quite as quickly, but they would have found out in Canada eventually if the police hadn't gone to all this effort. And honestly, that's probably the best thing the police did in this investigation. By the time her parents were informed, the murder investigation back in London was in full swing. The murder team was based in Wimbledon and a man called Keith Pedder was put at the head of it. He'd recently been promoted and it was finally his time to shine. But straight off the bat, this was a lot of pressure, especially for somebody who hadn't really dealt with an investigation of this level before. And as we know, the media were following their every single move and they knew the likelihood was this murderer was going to attack again. Like, they were on a time crunch. They had to find him, or at least find somebody, at least, apparently. So the very first step in this investigation was to talk to hundreds of people who had been on the common that morning and in the surrounding areas as well. They had to find somebody who had sighted a man walking away from the common covered in blood, because surely this guy was going to be covered in blood, right? Like, he stabbed her 49 times. He was going to be soaked head to toe. He wasn't going to be able to walk down the street without being seen by someone. But somehow, impossibly, he had. Not a single person reported seeing a blood-soaked man walking around Wimbledon. In fact, nobody reported seeing anyone suspicious at all. So the only witness they had was little 2-year-old Alex, who was, in fairness, about to turn 3, I think, in a month's time, but still, he was 2 years old. How much could they rely on the memory of a very traumatised 2-year-old boy? Alex was taken to a child psychiatrist who was to help him relive the murder of his mother. The police had to know at least a vague description of this man to know what direction to begin looking in. Apparently, Alex was playing with toys as the psychiatrist was asking him what he could remember, but this was clearly traumatising for him. He just kept playing louder and louder in an attempt to block out their voice. On another occasion, he was drawing his mother and then started stabbing the drawing with a pen faster and faster. Clearly, he was having a really hard time with this, but didn't really have the language, the skills to vocalise what he was feeling. Like, it feels cruel, doesn't it, to put him in front of a psychiatrist and get this information out of him? But they needed to find this guy. In the end, they did manage to get a vague description out of Alex. He described the attacker as a white man with short dark hair. He was wearing a white shirt, blue trousers and dark shoes. And he was also carrying a black bag. And it was this black bag that he pulled the knife out of before he started attacking. It was something, but it wasn't much to go on. It was all very generic. And there was nothing to be found at the scene either. Like, forensics were very much a thing in 1992, and DNA evidence could be used to convict a suspect. But somehow there wasn't so much as a single hair that was found. There were no fingerprints, no semen or bodily fluids. There was just nothing to go off of. Was this killer incredibly methodical or just incredibly lucky? Or were the investigators just not very good? It would later be noted that when adhesive tape samples were taken from parts of Rachel's body, which is literally where tape is stuck to parts of the skin, pulled off and lets skin cells and DNA come off, they expected to find some male DNA that didn't belong to Andre or Alex. And they just didn't. But they also didn't find any of Rachel's DNA either. Like, this should have been covered in her DNA and skin cells, and it wasn't, but nobody ever picked up on this. The testing at the time hadn't been done correctly, and no one realised. That is very much a Chekhov's gun that will come back into play later in the episode, so remember that.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle. With Ultra Titanium Alloy Metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time. For water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates, not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
So, with no witnesses, no forensics, could the autopsy maybe provide more information? It was revealed that Rachel was stabbed a total of 49 times and she had major injuries to her neck. From the angle of the injuries, it was believed that the perpetrator was likely either standing to the side of her or even behind her, meaning that the blood spray likely wouldn't have hit the perpetrator. So whilst they may have had a little bit of blood on them, they wouldn't have been covered head to toe as investigators first suspected. They quite easily could have walked away undetected. And this definitely helped form an idea of the crime, but overall it wasn't that helpful. They'd been wasting their time and energy looking for a blood-soaked man who likely didn't exist. With nothing to go on, police had to look at every single person in Rachel's life as a potential suspect. They also had the public put forward nearly 600 suspects. They looked at every sex offender in the area, or so they said, and just nothing was of any help. They officially questioned 32 men and even came up with a master plan to catch the murderer in action. It's quite common that sometimes perpetrators will return to the scene of the crime. Not always, but it does happen more often than you'd think. And so detectives set up a trap in the clearing where Rachel was attacked. They set up surveillance cameras in a tree with sensors linking to an alarm if somebody had gone in this area. The ground was then also soaked with a special chemical that would silently mark somebody's shoe. So if they caught somebody who then denied being there, their shoes would undeniably show the evidence and the person wouldn't know. I think they knew going in that this was probably a last-ditch attempt, it probably wasn't going to work, but the plan was quite quickly foiled by teenagers who would go into this clearing probably just to drink and do teenager things, and it just wasn't going to work. And pretty soon the press also caught on, they published it in the papers, and the whole plan was ruined, so they didn't catch anyone. Nothing, no leads, no person panned out, and they were beginning to get desperate. The eyes of the UK were on the Met Police, London's police, and they needed to get this case solved. They needed to get the assailant off the street, or just get anyone off the street apparently and say, it was this guy, we got him, it's all good. So with nowhere else to go, they turned to a forensic scientist called Paul Britton, who visited the crime scene, took a look over the case, and came up with a psychological profile of the man that they were looking for. Britton said that this was a killer who likely lived within walking distance of the common, who just wandered home after the attack. He would have been between 20 and 30 years old, single and quite isolated, either living alone in a flat or bedsit, or still living with parents. He was going to have a history of failed or unsatisfactory relationships, and he probably would have been rehearsing this crime for years and years in his head before he actually did it. And the most scary thing of all, it was inevitable, he said, that this killer would strike again. And this is when they started to hone in on a man called Colin Stagg, who lived on Roehampton Estate, which was within walking distance of the common, where he would often walk his dog in the mornings. Investigators came to the name of Colin Stagg after many public appeals, including on BBC's Crime Watch. A woman, a potential witness at the scene, had described seeing a man behaving suspiciously minutes before the murder. He was following a woman, and so she helped the police create a composite sketch of this man, which did kind of also match Alex's description as well. But at the end of the day, this composite sketch was just your standard white guy. There's nothing particularly notable about his face, he was just a man. On Crime Watch, he was described as 5'10" with short brown hair, carrying a small dark bag. The only thing noticeable about this man was the fact that he seemed to be wearing a belt over his shirt instead of on his trousers. So they thought this might have been some kind of dog walking belt where you attach the lead so you sort of have your hands free and you can still walk the dog. You generally see a lot of runners wearing these with their dogs, but this guy was in a shirt and trousers, so he wasn't exactly out for a run. It was very weird. 800 tips were called in after this Crime Watch appeal, and several of them named Colin Stagg. Like I said, Colin lived on Roehampton Estate, which was less than a mile away from the common, and he just so happened to fit Paul Britton's psychological profile perfectly. He was 29 years old, he was unemployed and single, he always had been. He was generally thought of to be a bit of an odd guy, like socially inept and just a bit strange. And clearly many people had noticed this about him, all of them calling him in. Keith Pedder, the man leading this investigation, immediately clung onto Colin as a fantastic suspect, and certainly they had enough to bring him in for questioning and have a search of his home. In doing so, they were also able to tick off another part of the psychological profile, that this person would have unusual interests and hobbies. They found a whole load of items to do with paganism and the occult in his flat. They found drawings of pagan deities, pentagrams, a hooded black cloak in the wardrobe. And obviously, I do want to say here that paganism is a valid religion, like so many people are pagan, but this was 1992 UK, the satanic panic was barely over, they're going into this flat, they're finding drawings of pentagrams, and the police found it really, really suspicious, especially considering the circumstances and the fact that he matched the rest of the psychological profile perfectly, and now he was interested in paganism and the occult. So Colin Stagg was arrested, and in line with the law, the detectives had just 3 days to question him. And they said it was an uphill battle. Colin seemed to be evasive, he wouldn't answer the questions properly, he didn't really make much sense. It was all very suspicious to them. Whereas Colin has said in an interview since that of course he wasn't making much sense, he was stressed and confused, he'd been arrested for a crime he hadn't committed, he didn't really understand why he was being brought in for this. He went over his movements on the day of the murder, explaining how he'd gone with his dog for a short walk on the common between 8:15 and 9:15 a.m. He said he spoke to a couple of people en route and did mention seeing a menacing looking man. The police didn't really pay too much attention to this though, they were so sure that he was the man they wanted. Rachel was killed at 10:30 a.m. and Colin insisted that he was home by 9:15. However, one of his neighbours would soon tell police that she saw him walking to the common at 9:25 a.m, which Colin said he did do, but on an entirely different day. Of course, the police didn't come to Colin immediately. It took them several days, maybe even over a week, to come to his name. So by the time they actually got around to questioning him and questioning his neighbours, a lot of days had passed. But this was just more proof for the police that they'd found their man. He matched the psychological profile, and a neighbour maybe saw him leaving the house at 9:25 a.m, and that meant that he was lying about when he took his dog for a walk. All they needed was a witness to identify him, and that would be the metaphorical nail in his coffin as a suspect. But no one actually witnessed the murder itself, nor did anyone see a bloodstained man leaving the common. One woman at the common that morning, a woman called Jane, did say that she saw a man acting suspiciously around 10:10 a.m. She said he refused to make eye contact with her, he looked lost, he was acting strange enough that she made a mental note of him, but she just continued with her day as normal, taking her kids to a nearby pond. But a few minutes later, she spotted this guy again and said she was immediately concerned because it looked like he was following a woman. It's not clear to me whether or not this woman was Rachel, it's not really specified, but I do think reading between the lines that it might have been her. Apparently this guy disappears and a few minutes later he appears again, walking back in the opposite direction. She would later describe him as a tall man, about 5'10" at least. Of course, Jane was called in to identify this perpetrator in an identity parade, and she soon picks Colin Stagg out of a lineup. Despite him being nowhere near 5'10", Colin was a relatively short man. And with that, Colin Stagg becomes not only the police's number one suspect, but also their only suspect. No matter how much Colin protested his innocence, they wouldn't listen to him, which, hey, I do kind of get. All criminals protest their innocence, it doesn't really mean much. But Colin did admit to one thing. He admitted to nude sunbathing on the common, which they managed to match to a woman's previous reports of a flasher, and they charged him with public indecency, just as a little starter, like they wanted to get him for something, so they got him for this. So he was a weird guy without a doubt, a bit of an oddball, and they also discovered that his brother had been jailed for the rape of a 19-year-old girl, which just intensified their suspicions. But could they actually get anything solid on Colin? On the 21st September 1992, he's sent to court on the indecent exposure charge, where he's fined £220. He comes out of court all cocky, kind of loving all the paparazzi and media attention outside, because of course the papers are picked up on all of this, and Colin puts two middle fingers up at the waiting cameras. It was a very stupid move. It just kind of gave everyone ammunition against him, because they were like, look, he thinks he's gotten away with it, he's making light of this horrible, horrible situation. But I really don't think Colin quite understood the gravity of the situation, of what was going on. I don't think he realised at this point that they were trying to get him for murder. So whilst Colin Stagg was officially number one suspect, the police didn't actually have anything on him. Like, literally nothing at all, apart from being picked out of a lineup. So they do a super deep dive into his past. They find out everything there is to know about this guy. And it comes out that a couple of years earlier, a woman had put up an ad in a local Lonely Hearts column. This woman wrote, "Overweight, lonely, shy white woman, not very attractive, age 33, separated, waiting for divorce, looking for a white guy, 28 to 38, who, like myself, is understanding, caring, loving and honest." My heart just breaks for this poor woman, whoever she was. That is so sad. Like, not very attractive. Like, that breaks my heart. And who replied to this heartbreaking Lonely Hearts ad? Colin, of course. He took his chance and sent her a graphic sexual fantasy letter. Listen, I'm not saying he wasn't a creep. Like, he clearly was a bit creepy. But they didn't have anything on him for murder. As you would be, Julie was completely freaked out by this letter, and she did not partake in a back and forth with him. She just ignored it. And when she saw the name Colin Stagg coming up in relation to the Rachel Nickell murder, she came forward to the police and was like, hey, look at this. So when Detective Keith Pedder heard this story, he came up with a genius idea. Let's honey trap Colin. Let's get him to admit to his crimes in a letter, because they don't have anything else on him right now. He's clearly a very lonely guy who's not opposed to writing about graphic sexual fantasies and sending them to women. If he thinks a woman might be interested in him, might he admit to things that he might not otherwise admit to? Especially if that woman also has a darker side. Like, they were going to honey trap him. They wanted him to admit to his crime in a letter to a woman who maybe thought that murder was sexy. Literally, that was their thought process. They knew this whole thing was a risky idea, but like, almost self-admittedly, they had literally nothing else on this guy. And this plan would either confirm that their hunch about him was right, or would eliminate him as a suspect. It was no harm, no foul. How anyone thought this was going to be a good idea, I have no clue. Apparently it was approved by the higher ups, but like, this is the Met. They have a long and complex history of very bad decisions. This became known as Operation Edsel, and the first thing they had to do was hire somebody for the role of the woman in this scenario, turning to a policewoman from the Met Police Special Operations Group.
What if I told you that right now, millions of people are living with a debilitating condition that's so misunderstood, many of them don't even know that they have it? That condition is obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD. I'm Dr. Patrick McGrath, the Chief Clinical Officer of NOCD. And in the 25 years I've been treating OCD, I've met so many people who were suffering from the condition in silence, unaware of just what it was. OCD can create overwhelming anxiety and fear around what you value most, make you question your identity, beliefs, and morals, and drive you to perform mentally and physically draining compulsions or rituals. Over my career, I've seen just how devastating OCD can be when it's left untreated. But help is available. That's where NOCD comes in. NOCD is the world's largest virtual therapy provider for obsessive compulsive disorder. Our licensed therapists are trained in exposure and response prevention therapy, a specialized treatment proven to be incredibly effective for OCD. So visit NOCD.com to schedule a free 15-minute call with our team. That's NOCD.com.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle with ultra-titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time. For water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates, not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
She'd done plenty of undercover work before. She was attractive. She should be able to play this role very well. She took on the alias of Lizzie James, and still to this day, her true identity has never been made public. We don't know her real name. I can only imagine there's some sort of injunction in place that has always prevented the media from actually identifying her. So throughout the rest of this video, we will just be calling her Lizzie James, but like that was not her real name, she was a fake character. They thought that Lizzie would be required for anywhere from 2 weeks to 4 months. In the end, Operation Edsel went on for near enough a whole year. Edsel begins in January 1993 when Colin Stagg receives a letter in the post from said Lizzie James. Unbeknownst to Colin, this letter had actually been written by Keith Pedder. But in the letter, Lizzie talks about how she's a friend of Julie, the woman from the Lonely Hearts column. She writes about how Julie is a little bit old-fashioned in her views and she'd been scared by Colin's letter. But when she shared it with Lizzie, Lizzie was intrigued. She wasn't put off by his sexual fantasy and she was very interested in getting to know Colin further. And Colin, who was lonely and had admittedly never had any sexual contact with any woman at 29 years old, jumped at the chance to write back to her. Over the next 11 months, the pair would exchange 43 letters back and forth, letters that got increasingly sexual, increasingly concerning. Apparently, one of the main rules of Operation Edsel was for the detectives to never introduce anything new into the letters. They were to allow Colin to take the lead and they would just sort of expand on the things that he was saying instead of introducing new ideas and new conversations themselves that might sort of like take him down a leading route. However, maybe this is a spoiler alert, but a judge would later find that the police very much were shaping his replies because they weren't experts in this kind of thing. Like, is anyone an expert in this kind of thing? Simply by even sending him a letter, by introducing these ideas in the first place, they were shaping his replies. Like, by sending him this letter, they were already trapping him. There was nothing he could do apart from ignore it. And of course, he wasn't going to ignore it because he was lonely and here was a woman writing to him. Lizzie James, it would turn out, had some very interesting kinks. All of these wild sexual fantasies that she told Colin she wanted them to act out together, each letter getting progressively more messed up. And hey, I'm not one to kink shame, but we're not talking about simple kink here. But you'll see, we'll keep going, you will see. By March 1993, the investigative team were clearly not happy with Colin's lack of admission in the letters. There wasn't really much he was saying that was of any help in the Rachel Nickell investigation. So Lizzie writes Colin asking him to stop showing restraint in his letters, saying he just wasn't opening up to her enough. At one point he wrote about a fantasy he had of them hooking up in the garden, but Lizzie wanted more. And like, hooking up in a garden, that is very, very tame in terms of sexual fantasies that he could have been writing about. So Lizzie pushes him, she wants it to get darker, to be more dangerous. And yet the police thought they weren't pushing anything. Like, it's quite laughable really, isn't it? Lizzie told Colin that she wanted somebody dominant, she wanted to be humiliated, and he wasn't giving her what she wanted. Colin was a lonely guy. Even though he was clearly a bit intimidated by this woman, he didn't want the contact to stop. So on the 18th of March, he replies to her saying that now he finally understands what she wants. So he's written something in response. Far from being a cold-blooded psychopath though, he begins with a preface, saying that in it he's going to call her a few dirty names, but he doesn't want her to think that that's truly what he believes. He literally writes in this letter that he doesn't want her to think that he's a violent man. Yeah, not exactly the fighting words of a killer. After a few months of writing back and forth, Colin starts pushing for an actual in-person date with Lizzie because there were clearly some feelings there, like he thought this was for real. They'd been speaking on the phone for a while by this point and the police agree that it is time that they finally met in person. The murder team prep Lizzie, saying that all she needs to do was get him to admit to Rachel Nickell's murder. There were going to be plenty of undercover officers in the immediate vicinity in case anything went wrong, and the date was going to be in Hyde Park, this large open space, lots of people around, and they were like really prepping for him to be a very dangerous guy who might hurt her. But it was so clear at this point that Colin simply wasn't matching the psychological profile, but the police weren't about to give up. Like, they were so sure they had their man, despite it being so clear that he wasn't dangerous, he was just lonely. So, after months of back and forth letters, they finally meet in Hyde Park. Colin arrived early and waited underneath a big tree and just watched until he eventually saw a woman matching Lizzie's description and he approached her. It was her, it was all good. The day they chose to meet was actually Colin's 30th birthday, and so Lizzie presented him with a couple of birthday presents, a personal stereo and a baseball cap.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle with ultra-titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time. For water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates, not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
This was intentional because the idea was that he was going to wear the baseball cap and it was going to make him stand out in the crowd so the officers could follow him more easily. Lizzie suggested that they go out somewhere to eat, and Colin wasn't really sure because he was very self-conscious about eating. And actually, at 30 years old, he'd never even been to a restaurant before. This is the kind of sheltered person that we're dealing with here, a 29, 30-year-old with no life experience. But does that make him a murderer? Colin was willing to do anything to impress Lizzie, it seemed, including facing his fears and going out to eat, so he did it. But just how far would he go to impress her? Would he confess to murder? When they were at dinner, Lizzie started to talk, sharing her very dark past with Colin. She spoke about how she'd been abused as a teenager by an occult group, how she'd been forced to join in on the murder of a woman and a young baby, and how she'd cut one of their throats. Then apparently all the people involved in this all had group sex, and she told him it was the best sex she'd ever had. The fact that an investigation team even came up with such a story is shocking. Like, this is so depraved. But they thought this is what Colin would want to hear. Apparently at the time, Colin didn't have any reaction to this. He just sat there flat-faced. And the watching investigators thought this was a sign that he was completely unbothered by such an admission. Clearly he was just as depraved as Lizzie was. Colin would later say that he didn't have any reaction because he thought that this woman was off her head, that he didn't believe this story for a moment, but at the end of the day, he wanted to have sex. He wasn't about to call her out on it. But as we covered earlier, Colin was a pagan, and although he didn't call Lizzie out at the time, he later said he thought this was repugnant, as all human and animal life was sacred to him. When the day came to its natural end, Colin walked Lizzie to the gates and handed her a letter that he'd written before the meeting, a letter that he thought contained everything Lizzie wanted to hear. Keith Pedder would later claim that this letter introduced a whole new level of sexual depravity. It included descriptions of a sexual fantasy on Wimbledon Common. It spoke about a knife and descriptions of blood. And you can imagine the police absolutely jumped on this. But was this really a new idea that Colin had come up with by himself? Or had the police been subliminally pushing it through Lizzie and through her content? Thinking they were now getting close to the kind of information they wanted, Lizzie recorded a graphic sex fantasy on tape to keep up the pressure. Each time they met from here on out, Lizzie would inch closer to talking about the murder of Rachel Nickell. And of course, every meeting they had was secretly recorded. They had everything on tape. Eventually, Colin made a confession to her that he'd been questioned in the Rachel Nickell case. And Lizzie responded, saying that she wished he'd done it. Imagine if he'd committed such a crime and got away with it. Like, that would be really hot to her. She was literally enticing him to confess. And remember that he's super impressionable. He is desperate for sex. He really likes this woman. And it's a really good job that he didn't give in to the pressure and just confess to get what he was waiting for. Thank God he didn't ever confess to anything, because he probably would be in jail right about now. But she was literally asking him to confess, saying it was so hot. It would be so hot if he'd done it. And then in July 1993, one whole year after Rachel's murder, Colin was approached by the Daily Star for an interview in which he said he didn't do it. The investigators apparently realised only at this point that even if Colin did do it, he was never going to confess to Lizzie James. Maybe he just filed this away in his brain and refused to reopen it. It would be risky for him to confess to anyone if he didn't confess to the Daily Star. Apparently he was never going to confess to Lizzie, which I don't really get the logic behind that, but that's what they thought. But they were still so sure that this was their man, so Lizzie made one last push. In realising that he'd been questioned, she asked him for details, and Colin had been shown a photo of Rachel's body, it seems. Now, this wasn't an up-close photo, it was kind of taken from a distance, taken from an angle in which you couldn't exactly see Rachel's whole body, you definitely couldn't see her head or her hands. And this was important because Lizzie pushed for a graphic description of how Rachel's body had been lying, because only the killer would know exactly how her body had been positioned. So Colin described the photo that he'd seen. He placed both hands on the ground to lower himself down into the fetal position, and then as he pulled himself back up, he brushed his hands together to get rid of all the dirt that had gotten them from just touching the ground. Rachel, it turns out, had been found with her hands crossed over, and Colin is insistent that at no point in this demonstration did he cross his hands over, but the police said he did, and that was enough. In a last-ditch effort, Lizzie told Colin that if he wasn't that type of man who had never done that kind of thing, literally meaning murder, then he would never be able to fulfil her. I think they just kind of hoped that Colin was stupid, that he was so obsessed with Lizzie that he wouldn't realise what was going on, because it seems so blatant to me that they're pushing for a confession. But Colin apparently didn't clock on at any point as to what was happening. I mean, I suppose maybe you wouldn't if you're like far removed from the world of true crime. Apparently Colin just replied to her, "I'm terribly sorry, but I haven't," and also said, "If I have disappointed you, please don't dump me. Nothing like this has ever happened to me before."
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle with ultra titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time. For water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates, not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
This poor guy was just so desperate for human connection that he was even willing to go for it with this clearly unhinged woman. Colin never confessed to anything. Operation Edsel was a complete bust. I mean, to stop Lizzie from dumping him, he did tell her that he'd take her to a location where Rachel had been murdered on the common, but ended up taking her to the complete wrong location and said that Rachel had been raped when she hadn't. He just didn't know the details of this case. But somehow, on the 17th of August 1993, Colin was arrested again for a second time. And this time when questioned, he chose to stay silent. So, in an effort to get him to speak, to perhaps shock him into submission, Keith Pedder decided to have Lizzie herself walk into the interview room unannounced and identify herself as a police officer. As you can imagine, Colin was completely shocked. Interviewing officers even said that he was angry, but I don't really think that's much of a surprise. Like, wouldn't you be angry? When you're under the microscope like this, even the most basic of human emotions become suspicious, become analysed. But like, of course Colin would be angry. He'd been duped for months, he had fallen for this woman, and it was just all a ploy. Despite having nothing on Colin, after this now year-long investigation, apart from him matching the psychological profile somewhat and a vague physical description, Colin Stagg was formally charged with the murder of Rachel Nickell. Awaiting trial, he would spend the next 13 months in custody. As we know, the police's case here was not strong. They had zero forensic evidence, and all they had was this very poor psychological profile. Paul Britton, the profiler, did say that a man's deviant sexual fantasies could identify them as a murderer, but like, can it really? Like, really? Can somebody be convicted on the back of that and that alone? Apparently he thought so, but of course not. Apparently the CPS, the Crown Prosecution Service, did agree. They felt that there were grounds to proceed to trial at the Old Bailey, which is London's historic courthouse, and I'm not entirely sure why the CPS even let it get that far, but he was charged on the basis of claims that he had described aspects of the murder scene that only the killer would know. And Keith Pedder did say that he truly believed that this case was winnable to them. Like, they thought this was going to be a successful prosecution. I would love to see the case files as they saw them. I'd love to know on what basis they thought this was going to be winnable. Because based on what we all know in hindsight, I can't really see how they thought they had anything against Colin at all. The case reached the Old Bailey finally in September 1994 and the process to trial began. But even before a jury could be sworn in, the defence started to make the argument that all of the Lizzie James evidence should be thrown out. And I'm sure the reasons here are obvious, but they believed the operation was deceptive, that underhanded techniques had been used in an attempt to get Colin to confess. They tried to coerce him and it hadn't even worked. The judge, Mr. Justice Ognall, took several days to consider their argument before coming back and making a ruling that apparently none of the investigators ever expected. He condemned the undercover operation as a substantial attempt to incriminate a suspect by positive and deceptive conduct of the grossest kind. He also said that the police had shown excessive zeal in their attempt to incriminate Colin. On that basis, he banned all of the entrapment evidence, saying that Colin's descriptions of the murder were nowhere near as close as the police had made out. That was basically all they had against him beside the psychological profile. And the judge also said that he didn't believe that a psychological profile could be used to convict anyone ever. The judge was very harsh in his condemning of the police investigation, and in my opinion, rightly so. I can't even fathom how this was allowed to happen in the first place, like how it was allowed to get this far. If you think Colin Stagg was guilty, then investigate it. Don't try to trap him into a corner. The investigators said they felt like they'd been hung out to dry at this point, but like, how do they think Colin felt? So Colin Stagg walked out of the Old Bailey that day as a free man after 13 months in custody. He was finally free to continue about his life, but of course, it wasn't going to be that simple. Although legally the police had no evidence against him, plenty of people still thought he'd done it. They thought he just got off thanks to a loophole. Rachel's parents said that they were devastated by this outcome, that the law had been upheld, but they didn't feel like there had been any kind of justice that had taken place. They just wanted answers for their daughter. They wanted to know that whoever had killed her was going to be locked away, that he was off the streets. And they trusted the investigators implicitly, like they thought the investigators were doing the right thing, but now they didn't really know what to believe. Meanwhile, the police, Keith Pedder, saying that the case was still going to be kept open, but that they wouldn't be looking for anyone else, reading between the lines to say that they believed they already had their man, why waste resources and carry on looking? Keith told ITV for their Real Crime documentary on this case in 2001, Colin Stagg has been through a version of justice, albeit truncated, and he has been found not guilty. But I wonder whether he can actually say, hands on heart, that he believes people will meet him in the street and believe that. I do not believe the system served anybody that particular day. Ultimately, his career was destroyed by this case. He became somewhat of a pariah. He was blamed for the failure, for the embarrassment of Operation Edsel. Exactly how much blame should be put at his feet, I don't really know, but he was the one heading this investigation. He said it was all approved by higher ups in the Met, by Crown prosecution lawyers at the highest level, but it all fell back on him. Somebody had to be blamed for this failure and it ended up being Pedder. He ended up taking an early retirement from the police on the grounds of ill health, and he did later face corruption charges, but the case was thrown out in a pre-trial hearing because of insufficient evidence. So with Colin Stagg now being set free, that was it. There was no more active investigation into Rachel Nichelle's murder. There was no one looking for who had actually killed her, for a few years at least. Colin Stagg obviously sued the police for damages of £1 million. He lodged a complaint against Paul Britton with the Psychological Society for the so-called psychological profile. In January 2007, after the actual killer was apprehended, the Home Office did confirm that he was going to receive compensation for wrongful prosecution, and he got £706,000 in total, which honestly, I'm not sure that's enough for just over a year in custody, but it's what he got, over 10 years after the fact. Lizzie James, again not her real name, took an early retirement from the police force in 1998, 4 years after the failed court case. I'm unsure if Operation Edsel had much to do with that, but she did actually sue the Met Police for damages thanks to this whole ordeal. And in 2001, the case was settled outside of court for £125,000. Apparently, she sustained serious psychiatric injury from this whole situation, and I don't know if it was from the ordeal as a whole or just the story she was made to tell Colin. But in my personal opinion, I don't think she was coerced into this. Like, she would have agreed to take a part in this. She was a willing participant and her identity was never even released to the public. So I'm not entirely sure why she got so much compensation. And this was hugely controversial at the time. People were really unhappy with her getting not only a payout, but one of such a significant amount. Especially considering that little Alex, Rachel's son who had witnessed this entire thing, had only been granted £22,000 from the Criminal Injuries Compensation Authority. And don't get me wrong, 22k isn't an amount to be laughed at, but it's not exactly going to set you up for life, and like, that is the least that Alex deserved. In the aftermath of Rachel's death, Andre was left to not only navigate fatherhood on his own, but to do so whilst dealing with the worst grief imaginable, huge amounts of media intrusion, and a toddler who had also been through horrific trauma. He told Lorraine in a 2021 interview that in the end it was routine that pulled him through, that the days were okay but the nights were awful. He said in those times Rachel was always his reference point. He was always asking himself, like, what would Rachel have wanted? And because he knew her so well, because they had such a deep connection, he was able to lean on that for a really long time. But just 5 months after Rachel's death, Andre decided that the best thing for his family, for himself, Alex, and their dog Molly, was to leave the country. The press had started following Alex, a literal 3-year-old, to nursery. The police wired their house in case Alex revealed detail about the murder. Alex had to attend grueling child psychology sessions in which he had to relive everything over and over again. Which I get to an extent, I really do. The investigators had to find out what he knew. But he was a toddler, like, it shouldn't have been his responsibility to solve this case. So Andre decided it was in Alex's best interest just to leave England. At first they moved to the south of France, living in a remote area near Montpellier, and then 3 years later they moved to Spain and settled in the Catalan countryside. No one over there in France or Spain knew about Rachel, no one knew about their past. Alex was able to grow up with a normal childhood and they could just move on without the trauma and the media hanging over them. Honestly, I think that's the best decision he ever could have made for his son.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle with ultra titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time. For water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates, not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
You have 5 new messages. Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week? Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
Nowadays, Alex lives in Barcelona and he does talk to the press on occasion. In 2021, there was a Channel 4 drama called Deceit, all about this case, or more so about Operation Edsel, and this obviously brought forward a lot of renewed media attention into Rachel's case. Alex and Andre did do multiple interviews around this time. They even came back to London and visited Wimbledon Common for the first time since the murder. And Andre said that he sees a lot of Rachel in their son every day. He said, "Her sharpness of intelligence, her wicked sense of fun, and her movements too. Rachel was tall and elegant, a dancer. Alex has that same elegance. You see it in his gestures, his eyes, his presence. You can just tell that he loved Rachel and his son so, so much. Like, he did everything. He uprooted his entire life to make Alex's life easier, channeling Rachel in every parenting decision. Like, it makes me emotional to even think about it. Like, the things that parents would do for their kids. And Alex went through so much. He was so young." I personally haven't watched to see the Channel 4 drama about this. It is based on this story, but obviously parts of it would have been fictionalised or exaggerated, and I didn't want watching the series to affect my understanding of this case. So if anybody's seen to see, can you tell me, is it worth a watch? Does it match up with what I've shared today? Like, should I watch it? But let's get back to the case, as it was now unravelling. Colin Stagg had been set free. The police have said they're not going to be doing any reinvestigating to find the actual perpetrator. And Rachel's case just went quiet. But with each year that passed, there was more and more public pressure to actually get some answers. This was a case that really touched the hearts of the public. Like, people really wanted to see justice for Rachel and for Alex. So in the late 1990s, Rachel's case was taken another look at under a new police investigation called Operation Enigma. This was a look at a number of cases across the UK that were the unsolved murders of more than 200 sex workers and vulnerable women across Britain since 1989. Now, obviously, Rachel Nickell didn't come under either of those categories, but her name came up in this investigation anyway. It was a big case, a big name. Her name was kind of always linked to different cases, different killers across the UK. Operation Enigma was really interesting. It was a known fact that the police across the UK were pretty ineffective at solving the murders of sex workers. They just didn't really care to even try and solve them. Detectives would openly mock them, they didn't have any sympathy, the sex workers were blamed for their own deaths, the media just didn't care. But when in December 1993, a 20-year-old woman called Sam O'Poole was murdered, and then within 6 months, four other sex workers were also killed, the Leicestershire Constabulary detectives asked for an investigation across all police forces. Even just a very cursive look into this made people realise that there was an institutionalised problem. They looked back at murders of women dating all the way back to 1986, and Operation Enigma was born. The operation was run by the National Crime Faculty in Hampshire and ended up becoming the first step towards a database for violent crime. It has a huge impact on police investigations even today. In the end, a man called Alan Kite, also known as the Midlands Ripper, was apprehended for these crimes, or at least some of the crimes, but he couldn't be pinned down for Rachel Nickell's murder, and they tried to make connections, they just didn't exist. If you'd like a full episode about Operation Enigma and the crimes of Alan Kite, just let me know, because even just doing a cursory look for this was super interesting, so I'd be very intrigued to delve into it more. But in terms of connections to Rachel's case, it was just another dead end. In 2002, on the 10th anniversary of Rachel's death, Scotland Yard decided to take another fresh look at the case. They put together a cold case review team, they reanalysed statements from witnesses, they took another look at potential suspects who'd been dismissed, and also took a look at other crimes that could potentially be linked, committed by the same person. But most importantly, at this point in 2002, they started to utilise forensic and DNA techniques that had only recently really become available. In 2002, the Forensic Alliance team became involved in this case, looking at all angles: chemistry aspects, hair and textiles fibres, and DNA analysis. A super detailed essay of this case is available on the Forensic Access website, which is just like gold dust in a case like this, went really deep into all of the forensic angle. And they say in this essay that the first thing they did was take a look at all the clothing from the scene, from both Rachel and Alex. Like, this was a brand new, fresh start, taking a look at everything with completely fresh eyes, kind of forensic investigation. Then they examined all of the body samples and taping taken from the body, hoping to find tiny samples of semen, seeing as the first team hadn't been able to find anything. And then they looked at the evidence from the rest of the crime scene as well. So the first phase was to look for any foreign DNA that could have come from Rachel's attacker. They wanted to identify the specific areas of Rachel's clothes that the attacker would have been most likely to touch during the crime, and they had to reenact the entire crime scene to kind of figure this out. And this is where the aforementioned tape samples from Rachel's skin come into play, where forensic experts use simple tape to pull away DNA, like small amounts of cells, from the skin. It's a simple but genius concept. We're about to get scientific, but I've tried to keep this as simple as possible because otherwise it's very confusing. Before, when testing these tapings, they'd use a DNA profiling test called low copy number, or LCN, which basically works by amplifying relevant parts in small amounts of DNA until you have enough to analyse. LCN uses 34 cycles of amplification, so basically you're taking a tiny piece of DNA and blowing it up, so technically you should be able to read what it says. However, through using this LCN method, the original scientists hadn't been able to find anything. The forensic access team decided to take a different approach, using a lower level of amplification. They used the standard 28 cycle test on tapings taken from Rachel's intimate areas, and this gave a different outcome where LCN hadn't shown anything. Apparently, the 34 cycles of amplification was just too much, it over-amplified, leading to an excess of DNA and no discernible result. But with this 28 cycle method, they found a mixed DNA profile on this tape, most of which did seem to belong to Rachel, but there were some minor components from a male.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle with ultra-titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time. For water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl. It's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl. Happy Friday. It's Jen. Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts. Like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
They decided to dig into this tiny amount of male DNA more, and they went back to the original tapings and resampled them, but they were never able to quite get enough of the male DNA to find out where it had come from. But they knew it was there and they were going to get it. So they tweaked literally their entire process. They cleaned up and concentrated the sample extracts, they tried to eliminate as much external material as possible, they tried to get rid of all salt and impurities. They changed settings on their machines to make them as accurate as possible for what they were trying to do. And me summing this up in 2 sentences, like, it sounds like a simple process, but in reality it took 2 years. But in the end, they were able to successfully get enough of the male DNA to search in the UK's national DNA database. But by this point in the process, a man called Roy Green, who was kind of heading up this whole forensic search, had already noted some similarities between the MO of Rachel's killer and a man called Robert Napper. Napper had been in Broadmoor Hospital since 1995 for the murder of a young woman and her 4-year-old daughter, which bears obvious similarities to Rachel and Alex. Broadmoor is a high security psychiatric hospital here in the UK in Berkshire. Lots of people think it's a prison because it certainly looks like one from the outside, but they are a hospital. They treat people with the most severe forms of mental illness and personality disorders. People like Ronnie Cray, Peter Sutcliffe, Charles Branson, Robert Maudsley have all spent time in Broadmoor. Like, that's the kind of level of psychiatric illness that we're dealing with. A slight side note, I actually grew up fairly close to Broadmoor, and every Monday at 10 a.m. they test the siren for if somebody escaped. Like, you could hear it for miles. I actually think they put sirens in many of the surrounding towns and villages, and let me tell you, it never got any less chilling hearing it. And I'd forgotten about it until I was writing this video, and I've moved a bit further away now and I don't hear them anymore. Or do they even have the sirens anymore? I have a feeling they might have got rid of them. I don't really know. None of which is really relevant to the case, but the Broadmoor siren is not something you ever wanted to hear outside of 10 a.m. on a Monday. Like, honestly, it was a kind of thing, like, in this area, if you hear the Broadmoor siren, you get yourself inside and you lock the doors. And that is where this man, Robert Napper, was locked away. So by this point, his name was already on the forensic expert's radar, weirdly enough, when it had never been on the radar of the police. And sure enough, when they finally had enough DNA to put it through the National DNA Database, it struck a match. So they begin searching for more links between the pair. DNA was a really good start, but it was such a minute amount, and who knows whether that would have been enough to actually convict him, so they needed more. After the whole kerfuffle with Colin Stagg, after all the mess-ups that had already happened in this case, these scientists knew that they had to have something like foolproof. Any defence lawyer worth their salt would be able to argue away this DNA like that. They got hold of some of Napa's possessions that had been at Broadmoor, just untouched by him for many years, and apparently within these possessions he had a red painted toolbox, of which he was incredibly protective, like he didn't like anyone else touching this. And this struck an interest with the forensic team because they'd found a tiny flake of red hair in some hair combings that had been taken from Alex. When they compared the paint flake with paint on the toolbox, it struck a perfect match. Also, there was a layer of metal, steel, on one side of the paint flake, and that was what the toolbox was made of, steel. But still, they wanted more. At the crime scene, there had been a couple of footprints found, footwear marks, and a muddy bridle path close to where Rachel had been found. At the time, thankfully, police had made casts of the mark, and the experts found that one did match the heel of a shoe that was similar in style to the heel of a pair of Napa shoes, but it was ever so slightly smaller in size. They wanted to find out if there was maybe a scientific reason as to why this could be the case, so they headed to Wimbledon Common to run tests on the literal scene of the crime on the mud, analysing what happened to a footprint when somebody was walking around on this muddy ground. And they found that as the walker lifted a foot to take another step, a partial vacuum was created. This sucked in the muddy soil around the edges of the shoe, and when they took plaster casts of the footprints and compared them with the shoes, they found that what was left in the mud was a slightly smaller footprint than what would normally have been made. It was pretty foolproof. With these three pieces of evidence, Robert Napa was interviewed by Scotland Yard in July 2006. As I said, he was already in Broadmoor by this point for other crimes. He was 40 years old and had been diagnosed as having paranoid schizophrenia and Asperger syndrome, which I know isn't considered to be a legitimate diagnosis nowadays. I know people are trying to move away from that name, but this was the early 2000s. That was his diagnosis at the time. Don't get mad with me. It would turn out that in November 1993, the year after Rachel Nicole died, Napa had killed 27-year-old Samantha Bissett and her 4-year-old daughter Jasmine in Plumstead, southeast London. He had forced his way into their home and stabbed Samantha in the head and chest before sexually assaulting her. He mutilated her body and removed parts as some sort of like sick trophy. He then assaulted and smothered Jasmine, leaving her on her bed surrounded by her toys. It would be Samantha's partner Conrad who discovered the bodies the very next day. I think he lived there, or at least stayed there a lot, but he'd stayed at his dad's house on the night in question and would later tell the BBC that he wondered if Napa might have been watching for a while and decided to strike when he knew that Conrad was out. And it would turn out that is likely exactly what happened. Conrad said that when he first walked into the home, he saw blood on the carpet, but he just kind of assumed that Jasmine had knocked some paint over, so he went into the kitchen to find something to clean it up with. Then he saw Sam's clothes all over the floor and assumed there had been a burglary. Only then did he walk into the front room and find Sam, and then he found Jasmine in her room. He called the police and then just stood outside and chain smoked, saying he didn't really know how to react to something like this. He did suffer with PTSD in the aftermath, which I don't think will be a surprise to anyone, and even the police photographer who dealt with crimes on a daily basis had to take 2 years leave after what he witnessed in this home. I actually wish I could unread some of the things I read about this case, like it was truly horrific, hence why I'm keeping this fairly undetailed.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle with ultra titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time for water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
Conrad has said in his head he immediately made the connection to Rachel's murder, and he asked the police if they thought there was any connection between the two cases, and they said there were just too many differences. But by this time, they were already all in on Colin Stagg. Operation Edsel was in full swing, and they just weren't interested. But hey, at least they found the perpetrator in Samantha and Jasmine's case. One of Napa's fingerprints was found at the flat and he already had a long criminal history, eventually leading police to his door. It did still take them a number of months though. He was arrested in May 1994 and convicted at the Old Bailey in October 1995, where he also admitted to 2 rapes and 2 attempted rapes. From the get-go, he was held at Broadmoor. It was very clear that mentally he was just not okay. He was questioned in Rachel's case a couple of times. Apparently in the August of 1992, after the eFit picture was issued, he was spoken to, but by the October he was eliminated because they thought he was the wrong height. Never mind the fact that Colin Stagg was also the complete wrong height. Napper was then questioned again in December 1995 in relation to Rachel, and he denied any involvement, so they just believed him. But the sheer amount of crimes this guy is now suspect in is almost unbelievable. He first came to police attention in 1986. He was convicted of an offence with an air gun, but that was only the beginning. In 1989, they received a call from Napper's own mother, Pauline, in which she told them that her son had admitted to committing a rape on Plumstead Common. What a strong woman you have to be able to call the police on your own child. Like, that is a woman truly having other women's backs. And she actually ended up completely cutting off contact with her own son after this. But of course, Pauline was just brushed off when police had a look and no case matched what she was saying. A lot of the time, women don't report rapes and sexual assaults for a variety of reasons. There's shame, worrying you won't be believed, worrying about police treatment. However, that was not the case here. It would later come out that a rape at a house that backed onto Plumstead Common had been reported just 8 weeks earlier. Again, another attack that happened in front of children. It's suspected that Napper chose mothers with children and committed the crimes in front of them because it made the women more vulnerable. They were more likely to put themselves in harm's way to protect the kids. It's just a mother's love. Had the police actually done their job properly in 1989 and made the connection with this report, hadn't brushed off Pauline, Rachel Nickell and Samantha and Jasmine Bissett would likely still be alive today. But they didn't look into it, like they literally did nothing. It's also widely believed that Robert Napper was the green chain rapist, somebody who carried out about 70 attacks, some sources say as many as maybe 84 attacks, across South East London between 1990 and 1994. They were named after the Green Chain Walk, a load of pathways which kind of link South East London, where a huge amount of the attacks took place. The sexual assaults that took place were to varying degrees. One of the worst was in May 1992, when he tied a ligature around the head of a 22-year-old woman as she was pushing her 2-year-old in a buggy alone near King John's Walk near Mottingham. He repeatedly beat her, stripped her and raped her while she begged for her life. And eventually he just got up and ran away, leaving her alive but traumatised. I truly hope this poor woman was able to get the help she needed after this and has been able to live a beautiful, fulfilling life, because I just can't even imagine going through that and surviving and just having to put one foot in front of the other. Like, it just, it's horrific. After this point, one of Napper's neighbours did come forward, linking him to an eFit that had been released of the Green Chain rapist, and he was asked to come in and give a blood sample for comparison twice. And when he just never turned up, the police didn't bother to chase, they didn't follow up, despite somebody else also coming forward in this time and giving his name. He was just allowed to go on about his life. 3 days later, he was dismissed as a suspect because he was deemed too tall. He was over 6 foot tall and the rapist was thought to be much shorter. But Napper was known to walk with a quite significant stoop, which they would have known if they ever actually tried to investigate him, like, at all. Days after being dismissed as a suspect, he was arrested for possession of a firearm and ammunition without a certificate. When officers searched his bedsit, they found that he had a gun, 244 rounds of ammunition, 2 knives, a crossbow, and 6 crossbow bolts. They also found pocket diaries, hand-drawn maps of London, a London A to Z map, and notes written on the borders of newspapers. Notes like restraining somebody with cling film on the legs. On the A to Z map, he'd marked certain areas with black dots and dashes. He also had a fitness card for a woman from Eltham, placed on the page with her home address. This was really worrying stuff, and they did nothing with it. A psychiatric report wrote at this time that he was without a doubt an immediate threat to himself and to the public. And despite this, he was sentenced to just 2 months of imprisonment in December 1992. In April 1993, after he'd been released, officers then found his fingerprints on a tin buried in Wynn's Common, one of the Green Chain rape sites, and this tin contained a handgun, but for some reason, they didn't pursue it any further. They just let it go. He wasn't even questioned. Can we say that had the police done their job properly, that Rachel Nickell would still be alive? Yeah, most likely. He should have been taken off the street. He should have been pulled in for further questioning. They should have been more concerned about the notes and the maps. And they just didn't seem to care. What I am sure of is that Samantha Bissett and Jasmine should definitely still be alive if multiple warning signs hadn't been missed. From the moment Rachel was killed, her family were told that this perpetrator would strike again. And he did, and they still didn't make the connection.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle with ultra-titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time. For water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates, not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
Robert Napper was a rapist, a murderer, an obsessive peeping Tom who kept detailed notes on women that he stalked and fantasized about. He kept detailed records of the sites of potential and actual attacks on women. He was through and through a danger to women, which a judge at the Old Bailey during the Rachel Nickell trial agreed with, saying, "You are on any view a very dangerous man." On the 18th of December 2008, Robert Napper was convicted of the manslaughter of Rachel Nickell on the grounds of diminished responsibility. Thanks to his paranoid schizophrenia diagnosis, he couldn't be held fully criminally liable for his actions as his mental functions were diminished. Seeing as he was already in Broadmoor at the time of the trial, he was just kind of sent back there, and that's where he remains to this very day. His sentence is indefinite detention. It's not looking likely that he would ever be released, but hey, never say never. He is 58 years old today. Although Napper is highly suspected in many other crimes, he will only confess to those that he has been forensically connected to. So unless there's forensic evidence, he's probably not going to ever be linked to a whole lot of crimes. He was not a careful killer. He didn't go to great lengths to ensure that he wasn't caught. He was a danger to society who should have been taken off the streets many, many years before he was. And the family of Rachel Nickell should have seen justice many years before they did. This did not have to be such a long and drawn out process. The links were there and they should have been made instead of all the resources just going in on one man. And sure, if they thought Colin Stagg was suspicious and they were correct to look into him, they should have investigated that through to a natural end, alongside looking at every other possibility at every other possible suspect. When Napper was convicted, Colin did receive a public apology from the Met Police, which I think was probably deserved. But I also think Rachel's family deserved an apology as well, because they had to live through all of this. This case should have been solved long before it was. A private apology was made to Andre in 2008 by the Assistant Commissioner, but no public apology has ever been made. In a series of complaints, Andre said that the Metropolitan Police could have done more to prevent Rachel's death. So in 2009, the whole inquiry was investigated by the Independent Police Complaints Commission after Scotland Yard acknowledged the serious failings here. By June 2010, it was concluded that a catalogue of bad decisions and errors made by the Metropolitan Police led to missed opportunities to take Robert Napper off the streets before he killed Rachel Nickell and the Bissetts, and before numerous women suffered violent sexual attacks at his hands. None of these victims ever needed to die. They should have survived had the police done their job correctly. The Met Police accepted the criticism in a statement admitting that more could and should have been done. But no police officer was to face any disciplinary action because they had all since retired and one had even died. And that's it. That's where the case ends. Or at least ends for the general public, for the police. Because for Rachel's family and loved ones, they continue to live with a hole in their lives every day. A hole which is probably only more painful knowing that it could have been prevented. I never really know how to end an episode like this. Like, everything about this case was just failing after failing after failing. There were so many people hurt by this, by the Met Police. Once again, who would have thought the Met Police doing a bad job at investigating serious cases? Unheard of. I like to think some serious institutional changes have been made, but each year they just continue to prove me wrong. Like, it just never gets any better. I think this might be one of the longest episodes I'm ever going to upload, so if you've got this far, if you've watched all the way to the end, then thank you so much for tuning in today, and I will see you in the next one. Bye guys. Thank you so much for tuning into this week's episode of Mysteries and Histories. If you have a bit of time, I would love for you to go and leave a review wherever you're listening to this podcast and spread the word. It would be much appreciated. I'll see you next week.